This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. On April 14th, the news of a massive alleged EB-5 fraud hit the Northeast Kingdom hard and ricocheted around Vermont. The Securities and Exchange Commission says that two NEK developers and their companies have defrauded foreign investors in the federal EB-5 visa program. They called it a Ponzi-like scheme worth $200 million. The two businessmen at the center of the scandal are Bill Stenger and Ariel Quiros. But the EB-5 program is one that a lot of Vermont politicians and departments of state government supported and even played a role in. And that's left a lot of people wondering, why didn't anyone notice what was happening at Q Burke and J Peak ski resorts earlier? In a little while, we're going to talk with State Auditor Doug Hoffer about how he sees the conflict between government promotion and regulation of projects like this. But first, independent investigative reporter Hillary Niles has reported for VPR on the question of who knew what when, and she joins us now to bring us up to speed. Hello, Hillary. Nice to have you on the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Can you just back up first before we get into this question of who knew what when and remind us of what exactly the allegations are in this EB-5 scandal?
Sure. Well, J Peak Resort up in Jay undertook several projects raising money through EB-5. All told, they raised over $350 million from foreign investors, from over 700 foreign investors, each investor putting in $500,000. Each of the projects that they raised money for, it was to build the water park at Jay. It was to build hotels and townhouses and things like that. Also, ultimately, their grand plan for an economic development initiative in the NEK expanded to include developments at Q Burke, as well as a biotech campus in Newport. There were even other projects in the pipeline, too. Each of those projects that they raised money for, the money was supposed to stay completely separate from anything else. And the allegations from both the federal and state authorities is that Ariel Quiros, the owner, and J Peak president Bill Stenger sort of perpetrated, like you said, this Ponzi-like scheme where they mixed the funds up and used money from one set of investors to finish a different project, for example. Also, even that the money from the very first set of investors was used to fund Ariel Quiros' acquisition of J Peak, even buying the resort back in 2008.
And Ariel Quiros is furthermore charged with using some money for his own personal gain, for example, to fund a condominium.
Exactly, buying a real estate. Also, he's charged with using investor money to actually also purchase the Burke Mountain Ski Resort, pay off taxes, and use it for various personal expenses.
And Quiros and Stenger have both denied wrongdoing in this case?
Yep, absolutely. They both have denied wrongdoing. And to be clear, in case any listeners aren't aware, both of the resorts are open. They're open under a federal receiver. So it's not like this shut down the operations. Great effort was made to make sure that, in fact, both of the resorts would stay open.
Although the status of the EB-5 investors remains unresolved at this point, whether many of them will actually get the visas that they believe they were entitled to for these investments, which were unsecured investments. So their money may be gone and they may not get their visas, but that's still up in the air.
Exactly.
Hillary, your recent story for VPR focused on a question that many people have asked, which is, what did members of Governor Peter Shumlin's administration know about this alleged scam, and when did they know it? So why, first of all, would the governor's office be in a position to know anything about what was going on at Q Burke?
Sure. So J Peak's EB-5 projects were all undertaken, and when I refer to J Peak, I include Q Burke and ANC Bio, because those projects were run through J Peak generally. So J Peak's EB-5 projects were all undertaken through an agreement with the state's Agency of Commerce. That agency runs Vermont's EB-5 Regional Center. So even though the EB-5 program itself is a federal visa program and states are not necessarily involved, and actually, in almost all cases, it's private enterprises that start these EB-5 regional centers to raise money for private developments. But Vermont is unique in that the state created its own regional center that was and continues to be wholly owned, operated, and administered by the state. Up until 2014, when Michigan did the same thing, Vermont was actually the only state to fully run its own regional center. So all of JPEEK's EB-5 projects and other EB-5 projects by other companies in Vermont have to go through the state to get permission to raise this money.
Okay, so I mentioned that the federal government and the state both filed charges against Bill Stenger and Ariel Quiros on April 14th. From what you've been reporting, how long before that did the administration have some indication of this alleged fraud?
So concerns about commingling of funds were actually raised back in 2012, when a business associate of JPEEK, an immigration lawyer named Doug Hume, publicly severed ties with the resort. He published a letter stating that JPEEK's financials were essentially not to be trusted. And so state officials say that they looked into that to a limited degree at the time, but apparently Hume did not provide documentation to sort of prove the basis for his concerns. And it also turns out that Hume and the JPEEK principals seemed to have a disagreement over some other aspects of their business together. So the regional center back in 2012, you know, these concerns were raised, but the regional center essentially chalked it up to sour grapes and trusted Bill Stenger's assurances that nothing was amiss. Then in November of 2014, similar concerns were raised about commingling, this time by an early investor in JPEEK, who had gotten his hands on some limited documentation. The investor is a gentleman named Tony Sutton. He sent the regional center excerpts from a couple bank statements dating back to 2008 and 2009. And those statements appeared to show transactions that Mr. Sutton believed raised concerns about who was controlling the money that he and his fellow investors had put into JPEEK. The statements also showed margin accounts, basically evidence of using the investor money to as collateral to take out loans. There was no provision for that in the investor agreements. There was also even an indication that millions of the very first project, the Tram House Lodge, there was an indication that millions of those investment dollars had been transferred out of their account even before JPEEK broke ground on the hotel. Now, public records show that the regional center began questioning JPEEK about those documents immediately. They expressed concerns explicitly about whether money from the resort's various projects was actually being managed separately as it was supposed to be. So remember, this is back in fall 2014. And so basically the state had concerns about the commingling, potential commingling of funds back then. And the answers from JPEEK were not necessarily forthcoming. The state asked for financial documentation and for explanations, none of which were really fully satisfactory at that time.
So the EB-5 Regional Center was immediately looking into these questions about finances as early as the fall of 2014. One of the questions here, though, is then what did the administration do or what did the regional center officials do beyond looking into these questions when it came to supporting the EB-5 projects and allowing solicitation of further investments to move forward?
So the thing to know here is that, yes, the regional center began asking once they got this email from Tony Sutton in November 2014, the regional center immediately responded and began asking JPEEK officials and representatives, you know, what gives? What's this about? Please explain this. The thing to know is, though, that even before that, before they were looking into those financials and concerns of commingling, there had been other problems with JPEEK. Another issue also involving Mr. Sutton came up in the summer of 2014 when those first batch of investors found out that their equity shares in the Tram House Lodge had been converted to debt without their knowledge, which in other words, means that JPEEK, basically Ariel Quiros and Bill Stenger, had said, okay, you had an ownership stake, but we're going to just change that into an IOU. that happened. And then apparently Jay Peak forgot to tell the investors. They were very unhappy with this change. The state was also pretty unhappy that it did not even know that this had happened. So that was one problem back in 2014 in the spring and summer. Also, the state public records show that the state regional center had had questions about ANC Bio dating back to 2013. Various, you know, sort of confusion about the relationship between Ariel Quiros and the parent company ANC Bio back in Korea. Various concerns about the marketing case for the product that was supposed to be made up at that biotech campus.
So it's safe to say that the state was had some concerns and was looking into this. Nonetheless, investment was allowed to move forward?
Exactly. So back in the summer of 2014, the state, because they were having trouble, they also found out that the SEC was investigating Quiros. The state actually suspended Jay Peak from marketing ANC Bio and QBerk. And so even when this concern from Tony Sutton came of concerns about commingling, even at that time, Jay Peak was already suspended for entirely different reasons. Now, ultimately, the resort did provide answers to the state to resolve those other reasons for which it had been originally suspended. Even though they were not providing the full financial documentation and explaining, you know, concerns about commingling, the state in March 2014 decided to release them from suspension. And even though they had launched an investigation in February of 2015, later on in March 2015, you know, at this point, there's a hotel that's half finished and there are investors in ANC Bio and these projects are just kind of stalled. So the state made the decision to, okay, we're going to keep investigating them because we do have these concerns. But for the time being, we're going to let them go forward with new protections to protect investors.
And the state told you, the state regulators told you they saw this as a calculated risk.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was a really difficult position to be in because, right, they have these concerns. But like I said, they have this unfinished hotel. There are contractors that need to be paid. There are investors who basically, you know, the new commissioner of the Department of Financial Regulation, Michael Pichak, served as the lead investigator on this case. And they had to say, okay, we have these concerns, but what if we're wrong? What if everything is okay? Well, we could really screw things up for the people who have put their money in, and so we don't want to do that. Also, you know, there are, like, there's this hotel. What good is a half-finished hotel? There are contractors that need to be paid. And, again, what if we're wrong? The necessary jobs that would be created by the construction wouldn't get created, and then the investors would be out of both their money and their green card options potentially. So they did. They made a calculated risk that the new protections they put on would protect investors. And just to be clear, those protections were to have the Department of Financial Regulation, basically the state, control any new money that came in. So the state wasn't touching the old money that had already been invested, but they were controlling any expenditures of the new investment funds to make sure that it would only get spent on approved expenses.
So those new funds were essentially held in escrow until they were spent on approved expenses. Does that protect those investors who have come in more recently from what the previous investors are now facing, which may be a loss of their money and a loss of a green card?
So the thing to remember is that there are two things at play here. There's the money that the investors are putting in, and then there's also the visa and ultimately the green card that they're hoping that money will buy. The protections certainly did protect that new investment money, but it's a complicated process of that involves time and that job creation, whether or not they get their green cards.
Mm-hmm. So they may get their money back, but the green card question is, as we said, for all of these investors who are still in the process, still in that pipeline, that's still very much up in the air.
Right. And it's really a mixed bag depending on which project each person put their money into and when. So the older projects, a lot of those people already have their green cards and they are more than likely all set and good to go. They may not get their money back, but they at least have their residency. Q Burke investors are probably in a little bit better position also to, whether or not they get their money back, they're probably at least in a better position to get their green cards because the state did allow the fundraising to go forward, which J-Peak used to complete the hotel. And so those jobs got created and those green cards are probably more likely to come through for those investors. ANC Bio seems like it would be more complicated because that project never really got off the ground.
All right. And we should say the state has said that it's been trying to work with the federal government on this to get some clarity on what ability the state has to help out in this situation and what rights and restrictions there are on these investors. And as far as I know, that is still in the process. There are some timelines and some deadlines for these investors that are coming up to prove that they have created the jobs that they were supposed to have created. So big question mark there still for many foreign investors. Hillary Niles, where are we with the federal SEC charges and the state charges at this point against Bill Stenger and Ariel Quiros?
Well, just briefly, Ariel Quiros is fighting the allegations and his trial may begin in late 2017. But Bill Stenger has apparently been cooperative. He's actually back on staff at J-Peak, and V.T. Digger reported recently that the SEC may settle with him in a matter of weeks.
So what questions are still left for you in this? Because we've been talking about this idea of what did the Shumlin administration know when? When did it start investigating? And why did it still allow investments to move forward? And there are lots of questions. There are lots of potential reasons. What questions are still left for you hanging in the air that you wish were answered?
Yeah, I think that the administration has explained why they allowed the investments to move forward because they felt like they were basically in between a rock and a hard place, and they wanted to see the jobs created. They wanted to see the economic development, and they felt that to a certain extent, if there had been a fraud perpetrated, that damage was already done. What good does it do to have a half-finished hotel? And maybe we can establish these new conditions that will protect investors going forward and at least stem the tide. So I think that was a very difficult decision for them to make. They made the decision that they did for the reasons that they had. And now it's just sort of a point of accountability and to understand that and to put the timeline together. One of the questions that I'm still unclear on is why back in 2012 more wasn't done to look into the allegations of commingling and also concerns about broker-dealer improprieties. Basically, the federal securities law, I'm still learning some of the details on this myself, but federal securities law is sort of strictly regulates how a commission can be paid to a broker who brings an investor into the project. In addition to the allegations that Doug Hume levied back in 2012, there were also extensive concerns documented through the public record of email exchange. There were extensive concerns raised with the state by an investment advisor about possible broker-dealer violations at that time. That investment advisor also, through his own research, came to realize that J-Peak had never filed what's called a Form D, basically a federal form saying that they're going to offer securities. And the state, in the records that I saw anyway, through public records requests from that time, the state didn't really seem to look into they didn't really seem to respond to the broker-dealer concerns. It's entirely possible that there was a response that was just not visible in the records, the basically hundreds of pages of records that I've seen so far. But I'm curious why there wasn't more of a response dating back to 2012.
All right. Well, we'll see if we can get some answers on that and more to come here as we discuss EB-5 issues. We're also going to be talking with State Auditor Doug Hoffer about why he sees this as an example of some conflicts within the state. Lots more to come. And listeners, you can join the conversation. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at VPR.net. Independent investigative reporter Hillary Niles, thanks very much for being on the program.
Thank you, Jane.
And you can read all of Hillary's reporting at VPR.net. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The EB-5 Foreign Investor Program was for years both regulated and promoted by the Agency of Commerce and Community Development. Now it's overseen by the Department for Financial Regulation. But this question of the government both promoting and regulating is a problem that never should have been created, says our next guest, State Auditor Doug Hoffer. Listeners, if you want to weigh in on government programs and regulation or on how incentive programs are monitored for success, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at VPR.net. Doug Hoffer, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Jane. Good to see you.
So
I hope you make
it
through the show.
Me too. It's an exciting hour. So one of the questions here for you, as I understand it, is that the EB-5 Foreign Investor Program, as we just heard from Hillary Niles, was monitored by the state. Oversight was done by the state, but it was also something that the state supported through promotion and through saying, this is a great program, and you have a problem with that.
Well, when I came to Vermont almost 30 years ago, I worked at the Community and Economic Development Office in Burlington, and that was created, as it were, out of the rib of the Planning and Zoning Office, because the administration understood that if they were going to move forward with CETO, and it would be an advocate and promote development of various kinds, it should not be attached to or affiliated with planning and zoning. It's just common sense. It's not about corruption or direct conflicts of interest. It's just a matter of human nature. If you are an advocate and a big promoter of a program, you might be less likely to see or acknowledge problems than an independent person might.
And did you raise those concerns with the state about this specific program, the EB-5 investor program?
Not really. I haven't been state auditor but for 3.5 years, but I think I'm on the record. One of your colleagues at 7 Days has me saying something about this 4, 5, 6 years ago.
Before you were state auditor, yeah. In fact.
Yeah. My only concerns over the years, because it didn't involve state money, I didn't make an issue of it in my consultancy, but I was curious about the data on job creation. And through the years, the federal government was very bad about providing that data. And I now know why, because I've had some back and forth with the Agency of Commerce, and there really isn't any solid data. Every investor who goes in hires a consultant. This program nationally has been a boondoggle for economists, accountants, and lawyers. And each one of them, for their $500,000, has to have an economist or someone with those skills produce an estimate using an econometric model that their $500K will produce 10 jobs. Interestingly, and not surprisingly for those who know about these models and the way the economy works, upwards of half of those jobs would be indirect and induced and not on the ground in the region. It's a related but separate and interesting subject.
In other words, if, for example, or maybe you may have a better example than I do, Doug Hoffer, but if somebody was able to say, my investment in this hotel project created jobs for a company in another state that creates the linens, the bed sheets for the hotel, and my job my investment created that job, they can count that job even though it's not necessarily
exactly
in the place. So
yes,
that's the type of thing that you're talking about.
Exactly.
And why is it a problem to be using those econometric models to determine the jobs that are created?
Well, it's not, except that those who say we've created X number of jobs, the reality is that only some of those jobs are on the ground in the region where we're most interested in seeing that job creation, which is in this case is the Northeast Kingdom.
Although that's perfectly legal within the parameters of this program.
It is. This program has a lot of things that are legal but are questionable. For example, they don't have to be permanent jobs.
Right.
Construction jobs are considered permanent jobs. So there's a lot of squishy stuff here. But back to this question about separation, real briefly, I think there are a couple of other examples in state government where I don't see a problem, but it's something to think about. For example, we did an audit of the Department of Liquor Control. Their charge is to sell spirits, but they also believe very strongly that their charge is to avoid significant social impacts from the consumption of spirits, and it makes it challenging for them. So that's one. The other would be, I think it's fair to say, the Department of Public Service, which has and has had a lot of really good people over the years I've been around, but they find themselves in that space between ratepayers and providers, energy providers of one kind or another, whether it's electric or other energy sources. And I think they would do better, the state would do better, to have an independent ombudsperson or group. And the other, which is really the big enchilada, is captive insurance. This is so complex, so convoluted. We're led to believe, and it may well be true, that this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And I know we make a lot of money. The revenue from this is outstanding. And I've never heard of any problems like EB5. And there may be none. And I certainly hope there aren't. But again, we have a small group of people doing both promotion and regulation.
So you're not concerned necessarily that there's fraud happening, just that this is an inherent conflict because somebody who's supposed to be doing oversight but who's also supposed to be a booster is not going to be in the best position to be doing the oversight when they're also a supporter and a cheerleader.
I think that's just human nature to some extent.
The other issue that comes up, though, is how we prove whether these programs that state government is a booster for or a supporter of are actually effective. And you mentioned, you know, for example, in the EB-5 foreign investor program, this question of, you know, how do you even calculate which jobs were created and whether those are valuable enough that the state should want them to be a part of the program. Are there other examples where you see issues with trying to get data, good data, on how effective government incentive programs are?
Sure. There are a couple that come to mind. One, tourism and marketing. The state spends now, I think, about $3.5 million a year basically assisting the tourist industry in marketing and advertising. Not surprisingly, however, that industry, which is quite large and has grown immensely over the decades, spends a great deal of money of their own, as they must, on marketing and advertising. According to the economic census, it's $80 to $100 million a year. So I don't think there's a methodology available to the smartest people I know to figure out the return on the $3.5 million in the context of 100. It can't be done. Yet the primary performance measure, if you go on the website, Tourism and Marketing, is changes in the rooms and meals tax, as if there's a causal connection between the two. And I don't think you can say that.
You mean, in other words, if we see the money coming in from the rooms and meals tax, the tourism department can say, well, look, we spent this much money on our campaigns to get people into the state, and look what it gave us, this much of an increase in the rooms and meals tax because people were coming in and buying meals and staying in hotels.
Interestingly, the department asked the legislature a couple of years ago to dedicate a percentage of the growth in rooms and meals taxes, to the extent it grows each year, to their program. And they said, well, look, you know, we can draw the connection between them. Well, if you, as the states or the legislature's economist ultimately did in a memo, if you really look at the data, the appropriation for tourism and marketing has declined over the last 10 years at the same time that tourism and marketing revenues from rooms and meals have grown. So it's quite the opposite of what they were proposing.
Plus, meanwhile, all of the private companies that are involved in tourism are doing their own marketing and trying to get people
huge amounts of, right. Another program that comes to mind is the Vermont Training Program, which we did a report on. And that program, according to the statute, the enabling statute, says that the training grants that go to companies are only to be for supplemental and not replacement training. That is to say, taxpayers shouldn't pay for the training that you would have paid for anyway. Yet the program does indeed fund a lot of training for new hires. And in my experience, if you hire new people, you have to train them. So I don't know that they're compliant with the statute. But furthermore, how can we say what the benefit is if some portion of the activities funded would have happened anyway? And that is certainly also a possibility for VEGGIE, which is the state's really flagship program, business incentives for new job creation and capital investment. And the whole program is predicated on a statement from a CEO or CFO that, but for this incentive, we would not create these jobs or make this investment or would do so in a much different way. And that may be true in some or perhaps many cases, but in others, there's reason to believe that some of this activity would have occurred anyway. So when you hear the program say, we are responsible for X number of jobs, I can't audit that. I simply can't do it.
And that was a big question or concern in a recent appropriation that was given to Global Foundries for the new hires, where the company had said that it would probably be hiring new people anyway. So this question of whether that would have happened without the state's investment or not.
Well, that one, there were three. Interestingly, the statute that created, it wasn't a program per se. It was a pot of money for the governor. He had to get approval from the emergency board. But it did, interestingly, say that one of the things the emergency board was to consider in their determination of whether to approve the governor's request is whether the state auditor could conduct a performance audit with the information provided in the memo that came from the Agency of Commerce. And in two of the three cases, I said no. There was insufficient information for me to do that.
Leaving those particular cases aside, Doug Hoffer, you are a numbers guy, as we well know. You are the state auditor, and you're very much into the weeds on how do we have the data to prove that these things are effective. And so I understand from your perspective and from the auditor's office perspective, that's what you have to go on, are numbers and data. Is there a case that you could make, though, for, you know, these programs are in some cases not going to be able to be determined effective by hard and firm data, but may still be worth going forward with, or even, you know, in the case of something like the Agency of Tourism, that the state should be putting in a good faith effort as well as private businesses to say, we also encourage people into the state. We can't prove that it's effective, but we think if we pulled the money out, it would be less effective. I mean, are there sort of squishy ways that are still acceptable?
I would be the first to admit that particularly in the area of economic development, it is very challenging sometimes to determine the benefit of a program. And it's certainly the case for prevention. If it's in health, fire, police, that's very challenging to determine the effectiveness. But in this case in particular, it isn't simply and should never be for policymakers who have the difficult job of allocating scarce resources. It should never be, we think this is working. The question should always be characterized as, well, there is this program. We know we have some issues about determining its effectiveness, but we have other programs. Perhaps we should consider diverting resources from one program to another where we know it works. And I say that to legislators all the time, and it's very challenging if there's a program up and running. If it's threatened, people come in and say, hey, you know, they have many vested interests.
When you present these questions and concerns and ideas to the current administration, do you feel like you are getting a good reception?
It's not so much the administration, although that's often the case, can be the case, but it's typically the legislature. They make the rules. I did share the report on the Vermont training program with the administration. They were terribly defensive. It was really unfortunate. They didn't take it seriously. I raised some questions about the way they report the outcomes from that program, the wages, and they could make some improvements, but they haven't and they didn't. And that's not surprising. People believe in what they're doing, but if someone comes along and says, here are some issues, let's have a conversation, it's not always easy. The legislature, for its part, I think over the years, everybody's well-intentioned. Everybody wants to spend the money and get good results, but it's very challenging for them to kill programs of any kind, particularly economic development, where they might be perceived as anti-business.
Given what we now know about what happened in the program we were talking about earlier in the show, the EB-5 Foreign Investor Program, and the fact that the state has separated promotion and oversight, are you confident in that program moving forward at the state level? I know it's a federal program, but it is something that the state is overseeing. Are you comfortable with that program?
I'm very happy that DFR is involved. They seem to be really nose to the grindstone, paying close attention, as they should. I don't want to weigh in on the wisdom of the program. I think it's a little screwy, personally, people buying green cards for investments. You know, if you have a good business plan, you should be able to get financing one way or another. I don't mean to, you know, minimize the difficulty of raising money, but this one's a little strange, it seems to me. And there are lots of people who would like to live in the United States and work and contribute. They don't have $500,000, so it always seemed odd to me.
Well, we are going to get more into that in just a moment. We'll be joined by the Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Financial Regulation, DFR, as Doug Hoffer just mentioned, and with the Secretary of the Agency of Commerce and Community Development. Doug Hoffer is our state auditor. Doug, I really want to thank you for sharing your perspective, not only on that program, but on this idea of oversight and promotion and how the state can be involved in both and what the sort of sticky wicket is there. I appreciate your time today.
My pleasure, and good luck. I hope things go well, and we look forward to having you back.
This is Vermont Edition. Coming up, more on EB5. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Earlier in the hour, we heard from Hillary Niles about her reporting for VPR on information sent to the Shumlin administration, warnings it received of potential problems with the process at QBERC and JPEEK involving the EB-5 visa program and foreign investors. We're going to double back on that question as well as talk about state incentive programs with two members of the administration now. And listeners, if you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Joining us now is Michael Pichak, Commissioner of the Department of Financial Regulation. It's nice to have you on the program, Commissioner. Thanks for making the time for us.
Well, thank you, Jane. It's great to be here as well.
We're also joined by Patricia Moulton, the Secretary of the Agency of Commerce and Community Development. Pat Moulton, nice to have you back. Thanks.
Thank you, Jane. Great to be here.
So, Pat Moulton, I want to give you a chance first, Secretary, to respond to what we just heard from State Auditor Doug Hoffer about how difficult it can be to actually gauge the effectiveness of state incentive programs like tourism and marketing programs, like VEGGIE, the business incentive program, like the job training program, how difficult he finds it for his office to actually either audit or find any information that is really distinct about the effectiveness of the state program and the state money that's going into it.
Great. Thanks, Jane. And kind of difficult to figure out where to start here. But as it relates to tourism and marketing, very clearly we need to market Vermont as a tourism destination. There's a lot of competition in the United States and internationally. So for us to make sure Vermont is on the radar for vacationers is critically important. And as Doug indicated, there's a lot of smart people who just can't seem to find a methodology to link the dollar spent on tourism with the dollar that with attracting a specific tourist. But we all know intuitively and through years in science that marketing helps. I use Prilosec as an example. I mean, years ago, you never saw prescription drugs being advertised, and I hear the story that they decided to take a shot at advertising if they could double sales, but sales increased by several hundred percent.
But presumably nobody but the drug manufacturer is marketing Prilosec, whereas in the case of something like tourism, you've got all of these different entities marketing essentially the same place, although from different angles. So it seems like it's more difficult to parse those numbers.
Well, they are all marketing for their specific destination. We're marketing Vermont in its entirety. We have to get people to Vermont before they decide whether they're going to go to Killington or Stowe or Shelburne Farms. So it's getting it, you sell Vermont first. It's similar when you're trying to attract new businesses, you're selling Vermont, and then you worry about selling the specific location. And as it relates to programs like the Vermont Training Program, I mean, there are what that program does is train Vermonters. It trains Vermonters to take jobs with Vermont employers, and we have helped train thousands and thousands of Vermonters over the years. And we ask applicants to sign statements that this is not supplanting or replacing other training that they would do. But it's just a reality that a lot of folks who are available for jobs don't lack this or may lack the specific skills that employers need. And we supplement the cost to help get those Vermonters ready. And most cases, if not all cases, that training results in transferable skills. Similarly, with the Vermont Employment Growth Incentive, we have created literally thousands of new jobs and millions in new state revenue as a result of that program. And we believe the CEOs when they sign an application indicating that the material is true and correct. And we believe them when they say that but for these incentives, they would not undertake this expansion at all or in substantively the same way. And we look at things like film incentives. We don't have film incentives. Therefore, we don't have filming happening in Vermont. We see it happening in our states, in Massachusetts and others that provide incentives. And the list could go on of where certain activity is not happening here because we don't offer incentives. But I will say that our incentive programs are designed well, and they are constantly rated well by national rating agencies, and particularly in Veggie's case, where it actually does provide, and that there's a direct correlation between the jobs created and the incentive provided. In fact, if the jobs are not created, companies do not receive the incentive. So our program is a whole lot tighter, and that data is readily available, and it's continually audited and for compliance by the tax department in the case of the Vermont Employment Growth Incentive.
I want to get Commissioner Picek in here in just a second, but Secretary Moulton, before we go to him, on this question of the ability of the state to both be controlling oversight and be supporting or encouraging programs, do you think that there are ways that the state can do that effectively?
Well, first, Jane, I just also want to correct you. You made a comment that we had transferred oversight of the regional center to DFR, and that's not really true. We have partnered with DFR. DFR has taken over the compliance end, but we're very much a partnership in this regional center.
DFR, the Department of Financial Regulation. Yes, sorry.
Thank you. I don't believe it's ideal to have the same people promoting as doing compliance with programs, but it's done all the time. I mean, I use as an example business incubators where you have to manage the incubator, make sure the rent is paid, but yet at the same time you're providing technical assistance to help businesses grow. And Governor Shumlin recognized that when he asked us to make sure to bring in the Department of Financial Regulation as part of EB-5. So like with captive insurance, Agency of Commerce and Community Development does the promotion, and the Department of Financial Regulation does the compliance. EB-5 is a different animal. It's federally regulated and federally driven. And I would just add again that the compliance that we currently have in place is far and above what is required on the federal level. So I'm delighted that we have that. But I don't believe it's impossible to promote and regulate at the same time, but it's not ideal. And that's why we've created this separate system within the EB-5 Regional Center.
Well, and I want to move over to that. Michael Picek is Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Financial Regulation. He was just recently appointed by Governor Shumlin, but before that he served as Deputy Commissioner of the Department's Securities Division, where he led the investigation into the J-Peak EB-5 project. So, Commissioner Picek, again, thanks for being here. And I want to go back to what we were discussing earlier in the program with Hillary Niles, which is the question of should people in the state of Vermont have, taken more seriously concerns about potential fraud in the EB-5 investor program and maybe prevented future investments that occurred between when the administration was first given word or warning of this and when the actual fraud allegations were handed down.
Well, Jane, just once again, thank you very much for allowing me to be on the program. I think there's a story here that hasn't been told from the perspective of DFR, and that story really is one that the Department of Financial Regulation is proud of. The work that we did on the J-Peak investigation was done at a rapid speed. It came to a conclusion that resulted in the alleged allegations, both from our state complaint, and then also we partnered with the SEC and really had a collaborative state-federal partnership that largely advanced their case as well. So on your specific question, I think it's really helpful and important to the extent I can to explain some of the larger backdrop to the investigation and some of the important milestones. So we partnered with ACCD, DFR that is, in December of 2014. That's when our relationship officially began. And the first thing that we did was look at what is called ANC Bio, which is the seventh of eight J-Peak limited partnerships. And that was the specific entity that we were looking at in terms of reviewing and revising the private placement memorandum. So we met with them on January 28th of 2015. The day before that meeting, we had seen the four pages of Raymond James documents that you're referring to. And from that, we deduced that there was margin interest, margin payments, and that there were treasury bills being purchased. So that next day, when we met with the ANC Bio Project, we asked them specifically, why were their margin interest taken? Why payments made? Why did you buy treasury bills? And again, that evidence related to the Phase 1 project. So it was even a separate project than the one we were looking at. They told us they would get back to us on those questions. They did that in February of 2015. Their response to our questions then raised additional questions to us. That very next day, February 28th, 2015, we reached out to the financial firm Raymond James, asked them for the full account of the one that we had seen the four pages on. From there, we asked them for every account that they had related to Jay Peak and the project principles. And then from there, we began a very long and difficult process of piecing together exactly what had happened. During the course of the investigation, we reviewed 130,000 pages of financial documentation. We reviewed and analyzed 100,000 transactions. So if you look at the day that we began reviewing financial transactions, which was March 10th of 2015, to when the case was filed in April of 2016, we needed to look at, analyze, dissect 361 transactions on average every single day to be able to piece together exactly what happened here.
So is the situation for you here one where, in hindsight, perhaps you wish that you had been able to shut off the solicitation of more investors, but at the time, with what you were working with, it seemed like the best decision and in your estimation, was the best decision to be investigating but allow this project to move forward?
Well, Jane, I think it's really important to look at the two projects that you're referring to specifically. And let's start with the ANC Bio Project first. So when they were allowed to go out and solicit again in what was April of 2015, they were not allowed to use any money that came in. And they have not used a penny of that money that came in from that time through today. That money remains in escrow and is under the control of the receiver. So for the ANC Bio Project, 100% investor protection was in place for those investors, those new investors that came in. Regarding the Q Burke project, which was the eighth project in the series of eight, that project by July of 2015, we had done enough financial analysis to determine that that project was handled 180 degrees differently than the other seven projects. There was not examples of commingling. There were not examples of illicit or inappropriate transactions. It was just a completely different project, and partly I think that was due to the regulatory pressure that was being put on by the SEC, by ACCD, by DFR. And you'll see that by the fact that that eighth project was not listed in the SEC's complaint nor in the state's complaint. So regarding that project, in July of 2015, when they continued to raise money and they were allowed to do so, you're absolutely correct that the hotel was half built. And it was a decision that had to be made in terms of there are half of the investors already into this hotel. They're at risk if this hotel is not complete. The new investors are coming in to a project that is a project that's half complete. However, we needed to make sure that their monies, the new monies that came in, only went to the hotel. And that's exactly what we did. We put a third-party administrator in place that looked at the payments coming in, looked at the invoices, matched them up, confirmed the work was being done, and then and only then were the monies released for those specific expenses.
Nonetheless, Commissioner, there are a lot of people in Vermont who feel frustrated and are directing their ire at the state. We got a note from Mark who says, did the rosy promises from Stenger and Kyros of tens of million dollars in foreign investment and hundreds of jobs to come to a depressed rural region provide the Shumlin administration with an excuse to look the other way for too long when they had evidence of impropriety? He says, essentially, was the state knowingly negligent or just dumb? You know, that's a harsh critique, but how do you respond to people who feel like the state should have done more?
Well, Jane, I think I just laid out sort of the speed in which we conducted our investigation. We did what I just laid out in 13 months. By the time we began our investigation, the SEC had already been looking into this for 13 months. So I think that the anger and the focus really should be on the people that perpetrated this fraud. It should not be on the state. It should not be on any specific state agency. It were two individuals at the heart of this, and that's where the anger and the focus really should be on.
And Jane, I'd just like to add, too, that the department that Michael heads up also has greater subpoena and other investigative powers that we do not have at the Agency of Commerce. So until they were brought in, we could ask a lot of questions but could never dig as far as DFR has been able to dig. But I couldn't agree more with Michael. Let's put the anger at the folks who actually committed the crime.
Well, Michael Pichak is Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Financial Regulation. Patricia Moulton is Secretary of the Agency of Commerce and Community Development until September. Thanks both of you for making yourselves available. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you very much, Jane.
That does it for today. Listeners, I want to let you know that Debate Week is coming up on Vermont Edition. If you've only been paying attention a little bit to the primary races, this is your chance to hear the candidates. It's the first week in August here on Vermont Edition, and we want to know what questions you would ask the candidates. Go to vpr.net to submit your questions for governor, lieutenant governor, and treasurer, or record them on your smartphone's voice memo app and send the file to vermontedition@vpr.net. Then listen in all the first week of August. Our producers are Rick Sangary, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Liam Connors directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.